A lonely highway. Midnight on the Mississippi Delta. A young man stands alone at the crossroads. He's come to seal his fate as one of the greatest bluesmen of all time. And all he has to do is summon the devil to tune his guitar. And once the deed is done, the young man's dreams of fame and fortune will follow. All in exchange for the man's mortal soul. This is the legend of Robert Johnson.
For decades, the legend of Robert Johnson has been at the core of music culture. The Faustian tale of a man so desiring of success, he's willing to sell his soul for a taste. The story is centuries old, and yet the story of Robert Johnson is decidedly modern and uniquely American. It's spawned movies and television shows, and Robert's musical inspiration is vast. Eric Clapton, Keith Richards, Jimmy Page, and many more. And chronologically speaking, Robert Johnson is celebrity member number one of the postmortem cultural phenomenon known as the 27 Club. But where does a legend come from, and how does it take hold? On today's show, we'll explore that with my guest, Dr. Bruce Conforth, ethnomusicologist, former professor of American folklore and blues at the University of Michigan, and an original curator at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. His new book, Up Jumped the Devil, The Real Life of Robert Johnson, along with co-author Gail Dean Wardlow, traces Robert's life from his humble beginnings to trailblazing guitarist to his tragic last days. My name is Chris Kosach. I created this program to highlight the written account of music, from band biographies to memoirs and the occasional rock doc. We are the only podcast of its kind. This is Text, Prose, and Rock and Roll. Track 5, Robert Johnson. What is it about this particular legend, a man selling his soul at the crossroads in exchange for a supernatural talent, that you think galvanizes us so much?
Oh, gosh, you know, there's really so many things. I like to say that, you know, the music is what initially draws us in, but the myth is what keeps us there. There's so many things about Robert that fit perfect. One of the things don't seem to realize this, I think, is the idea of untapped potential. When you think about so many American icons, Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy, Jimi Hendrix, James Dean, so many people who we like to be able to reshape into a new image, as you know, can you only imagine if they had not died so young, what would they have done? And of course, Robert's, you know, untimely death feeds into that whole thing. We love to reclaim Robert, and that's what's happened a great deal since America discovered him in the early 1960s, you know, scholars, fans, all sorts of people have gone about recreating Robert and recreating the myth into something that was supernaturally mystic, you know, just drew people there. But then once they were able to recreate him based on the scant information they had, it was like full-blown American dream revisited.
I want to get to the legend and the tragic way in which Robert Johnson really died in just a moment, but I also think it's important to dig deep into who he was, and boy, did you dig deep. Tell us a little bit more about Robert Johnson, the man.
Well, Robert really was quite different than a lot of his contemporary musicians at the time. You know, we have a tendency to want to lump, you know, the blues musicians, Delta blues musicians, country blues musicians into this like nice, neat package of who they are and what they were supposed to be doing and all of this, you know, compact product. And Robert he's outside of that. From the beginning, his life is full of tragedies and hardships. He's born out of wedlock. He's the illegitimate child of Julia Majors and Noah Johnson. Noah abandons her before Robert is even 2 years old. Julia has no way of supporting herself. She travels around with baby Robert, in tow, until eventually she just really can't take care of him anymore. She brings him to Memphis and drops him off at her ex-husband's house.
It's a strange dynamic for sure.
You know, and what happens to Robert? He's abandoned by his mother and given to these people that he has no idea who they are. And she just says, bye. But Robert gradually begins to accept these new people as his family in Memphis. And this is one of the really important things that shapes Robert into such a different musician and such a different person, as I said, than many of his contemporaries, because he grows up in an urban environment. You know, most people, when they think about Robert Johnson, they think of an itinerant Delta blues musician traveling down dirt roads. Robert grew up in Memphis. You know, he grew up in an urban environment. He grew up listening to jazz bands. He grew up listening to records. He grew up watching Ringling Brothers Circus. You know, whether he actually was able to go to the circus or not, you know, we have documentation that Ringling Brothers came several times. Uh-huh. You know, and of course, they would always have the big circus parade, you know, down the street. And I'm sure as a kid, he must have seen that. And so many other trappings of modernity that really shape Robert as a very different person. And he begins to develop a very different idea about what music should be from listening to records and the radio. And he goes to school, again, unlike many of his contemporaries.
He was literate. He wrote letters to his sister.
Highly literate. He carried a notebook around with him in which he kept his ideas and his song lyrics and different things. He always had a notebook with him. And mm-hmm. he was an incredible reader. He would read anything he could get his hands on. So he had a different shape of the world. Robert's worldview, his zeitgeist, his Weltanschauung, you know, his whole perception of the world was totally different than someone who just grew up on a plantation. But then at about 9 mm-hmm. years old, his mother, whom he didn't even recognize anymore, he had completely forgotten her, because who remembers what somebody looks like when you're 2 years old? She shows up in Memphis and says,
right.
Guess what? I'm taking you with me. Say goodbye to your family. So Robert is ripped away from the only family that he knew. And she brings him to live with her new husband, a much younger, illiterate sharecropper on a godforsaken plantation in Arkansas. And I've been down there, and I'm telling you, it's really in the middle of nowhere. And I can just imagine Robert, you know, as he's being taken out of Memphis, you know, whether they took a truck or a bus or whatever, you know, but as he's leaving Memphis, he's watching all the trappings of urbanity disappear. The buildings are disappearing. The streetcars are disappearing. The people are disappearing. The landscape is getting more and more desolate. It's becoming nothing until he suddenly plopped into the middle of farmland. No school, mm-hmm. nothing.
And he's made to work on this farm. He's not a laborer.
No, he's not. I mean, the reason he was sent to school was because the man he considered his stepfather, his mother's ex-husband, who really actually was, of course, no relation to him, no blood relation anyway. You know, he was a tradesman. And so he was grooming Robert to be some sort of tradesman, which is why he sent him to school. And to be taken out of that and to be forced to work picking cotton, which is just the most egregious form of work. I mean, it was really backbreaking work, as they used to say, from kin to kin, from when you can see the sun until you can't see the sun anymore. Just really a miserable job.
And this is a kid we're talking about, too.
Yeah, 10, yeah, 9, 10, 11.
You write in the book that Robert learned some of his refinement of his skill from Ike Zimmerman. And this is where some of the first seeds of the legend start to mm-hmm. take hold. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Ike, according to Ike's daughter and grandson, Ike always said that if you wanted to learn to play the blues, the only way to learn to play the blues was to sit on a gravestone at midnight so that the haints could come out and teach you. And haint, of course, is a Southern expression for spirits or ghosts or whatever. And so there was a graveyard. It's still there, really quite close to where the Zimmerman shack was. And Robert and Ike would go to that graveyard at night. And there was a specific grave. We have a picture of it in the book. There's two gravestones. And they would sit on those gravestones facing each other at night. And they would practice guitar at night.
That is just a haunting and beautiful image. But what Ike's daughter said later, it is my favorite part of the book.
I know what you're going to say.
She said, there wasn't no crossroads. You had to go cross the road to get to the cemetery. I love that. Did she tell you that?
Yes, she did. Those were exact words to me. She said, yeah, yeah, yeah. She said there wasn't no crossroads. You just had to cross the road to get to the graveyard.
I'd like to talk a little bit about hoodoo further and how hoodoo, root work, conjure, how those practices crept into Robert's work. Do you think that was intentional or was it part of his culture?
I think it was cultural first. And then perhaps it may have become more intentional as it went on. But I think primarily it was cultural. And the thing that seems to me to be unique about Robert is the extent to which he used his references, because he used them so often and so specifically that it's almost impossible to imagine that he didn't have some real knowledge of the workings of hoodoo. For instance, in Stones in My Passway, you put Stones in My Passway, you've taken my appetite, my friends will desert me. The way he talks about stones, which is in your passway, that's called foot traffic magic, where someone would literally lay blessed or cursed stones across a path that they knew their victim was going to cross, and then when the victim stepped over it, they would get the full brunt of whatever the curse was. And you know, for Robert to talk about that in such specific ways, they put stones in my passway. You don't do that unless you've got some real knowledge of it. He talks about mojos. He talks about all sorts of things. Dusting my broom. Now, dusting my broom is often considered just, I'm going to leave. I'm going to get up and leave. I'm going to dust my broom. But in both Native American and African American tradition, the broom plays a prominent place in their folklore. And one of the things in African-American tradition is if you wanted to rid yourself of unwelcome guests or make sure that somebody didn't come in your house, what you'd do is you'd get your broom and you'd sprinkle like gopher dust or something else in the broom. And then you'd sweep. If you wanted to get rid of somebody, you'd sweep in all the corners of your house. And that way they'd have to leave. If you didn't want somebody to come in, you'd sweep across the doorstep. So dust my broom. It could be a kind of a double entendre, meaning, yeah, okay, maybe I'm going to get up and leave, but also maybe, you know, I'm putting this curse on, because he says that black man you've been loving can't get my room. So, you know, Robert had a very specific cultural knowledge of hoodoo that is it goes beyond just merely saying, oh yeah, my baby's got a mojo.
Or maybe he was trying to get a rise out of people when he mentioned the devil, because we are talking about the Baptist South.
Oh, sure. And also think about it. You know, how much agency did a young black man have in the South
Yes.
at that time?
Zero.
Not much. How do you gain agency? Well, one way you can gain agency is to say that you've got powers that other people don't have. I've got supernatural powers. You know, I made a deal. I've got this. I've got I've got old man Legba on my shoulder over here, so don't go messing with me. The crossroads, you know, was that magic place where all worlds intersected, and Legba was the guardian of that crossroad.
We're talking about a black man in Mississippi in the 30s, so we have to talk about the Jim Crow South. What sort of obstacles would have been in Robert's way? What would he have been up against when he went into Memphis to make his records? Would he have had some rejection, or would they have been happy to take his money?
Racism was the norm. It was beyond being the norm. And particularly in the Delta, you know, it's called the most southern place on earth. The lynchings. There were more lynchings in the Delta region of Mississippi than there were in the entire state of Mississippi. It was just a really horrific place. So what Robert was up against was really pretty bad. I mean, Johnny Shines, his traveling companion, hated to go into Mississippi. As a matter of fact, he said he wouldn't go into Mississippi because he said it was always open season on black heads in Mississippi. And at the end, I'll give you a little teaser for when we get to Robert Johnson's demise. This is something that really pained Johnny Shines, because Robert wanted Johnny to go with him when Robert was heading down to Greenwood, Mississippi, where he ultimately met his demise. But Johnny wouldn't go with him because of what I just said, but that it was always open season on blacks, and so he just wouldn't go into Mississippi. And after Robert met his end, even, you know, as an older man, Johnny really regretted not having gone with him, because he thought, you know, if I had gone with him, maybe I could have stopped Robert from meeting his end. So, yeah, I mean, there was just horrific racism. But by the same token, yeah, white record company, they're going to make any money they can off black people. You know, what else is new? You know,
I found it really fascinating that even 100 years ago, the record labels were screwing the artists and anybody who brought them music. And again, it is not funny at all. So that practice has been going on forever.
Forever. Yes, indeed. I mean, you know, people got the artists got paid by the recording. There were no contracts. There were no royalties. So Robert would get like maybe 15 or 20 bucks for every song that he recorded, which was a good payday, because if he recorded 10 songs, you know, he walks out of there with $200. $200 is not a bad payday, you know. But that's it. That was it. You know, the record company then went on to make all the rest of the money.
Right. Other than the blues, do we have any recordings of Robert speaking, being interviewed, anything like that?
Unfortunately, not that I'm aware of, you know, and it's too bad, because when they played for Reverend C.L. Morton's radio show in Windsor, Ontario, there was almost unquestionably a radio recording made so that they could use it for, you know, other broadcasts. So there's almost certainly there was a recording made of them performing, you know, singing gospel songs. God, can you imagine what it would be like to have a recording of Robert Johnson doing gospel? But those, you know, those recordings were long ago destroyed.
Let's talk a little bit about New York, because John Henry Hammond, the millionaire, had something to do with the genesis of the legend. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, Hammond was part of the Vanderbilt family. You know, he was related to the Vanderbilt, so he was an incredibly wealthy individual who had been sent to Yale, dropped out of school because he wanted to get an apartment in the village and devote himself to promoting and reviewing Black music. You know, he had this great affinity for Black music. And he did. I mean, he produced some of Bessie Smith's last recordings and things like that. And of course, in 1938, he does this From Spirituals to Swing concert at Carnegie Hall, which is an important part of the Robert story. So in 1937, he's writing for a communist magazine, an American communist magazine called New Masses. Yes, New Masses. And in 1937, he produces the very first review of a Robert Johnson recording in New Masses, in which he says that Robert Johnson is like the greatest thing ever. And think about it. I mean, at the time, Lead Belly had just been, if you could see me, I'm doing quotes with my hands, rediscovered or discovered. And so Lead Belly was like the darling of the particularly New York left-wing intelligentsia. They saw Lead Belly as being the true voice of the primitive Negro, you know, the real voice of the American proletariat. And in that 1937 review, Hammond says that Johnson is so great that he makes Lead Belly sound like a poser. Whoa, that's heretical at the time. That's absolutely heretical. But it launches, like, it begins to launch the myth of Robert Johnson. Who is this guy? Who is this great guy that's being promoted here? And so in 1938, Hammond wanted to put on a concert at Carnegie Hall called Spirituals to Swing, in which he traces the entire history of African American music. And, you know, and its influence on pop music. And so he was going to have jazz and spirituals and gospel and everything that you could imagine. And the biggest names were taking part in it. And he was so sure of himself that he wanted Robert Johnson, you know, to be the blues singer, you know, the country blues singer, that he actually had Robert's name printed on the original advertisement before he even tried to get in touch with Robert. And when he did send a scout down to try and find Robert to let him know that he wanted him for that concert, they found out that Robert had been killed, that he died. But he's not going to be without Robert Johnson. And so there's this great scene where at one point, you know, the house lights go down, a spotlight in Carnegie Hall shines on a Victrola sitting in the middle of the stage, and out walks Hammond. And Hammond gives this speech about how, you know, if only things had been different, Robert Johnson would have been here tonight, and he would have really been the great star of the evening. But horror of horrors, Robert Johnson died at the exact moment when scouts got to him and told him that he was going to appear at Carnegie Hall. Again, creating more myth. Hammond is recreating Johnson yet again. He's recreating Johnson yet again.
You mentioned Barnum and Bailey earlier. Yeah. There's a little bit of P.T. Barnum going on here.
Absolutely, absolutely. But anyway, Hammond plays these two songs for the crowd, and the crowd went absolutely wild. They went crazy. And it's really kind of at that time that the Johnson myth really kind of begins to take off. You know, again, in a very niche market, again, you know, New York intellectuals largely, people like Alan Lomax and people like that. But, you know, it really starts at that point.
Okay, so let's head back down to Mississippi. It's August 1938. Robert heads to Greenwood. He's alone, and all of his real demons, like his love of alcohol and women, married or not, they all start to factor into his final days, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they never left him. I mean, you know, what happened to Robert in Greenwood could have happened any time before, because this was just par for Robert's, you know, modus operandi. I mean, this is what he did. You know, wherever he went, he would fixate upon a particular woman that he had a liking for, or whom he thought could take care of him, and he'd go after her, married, single, did old, young, good looking, not good looking, didn't matter to Robert at all. You know, I mean, and so in Greenwood, Robert had been playing at a place called Three Forks, which was a general store for the Star of the West plantation in Greenwood. And one of the people who worked at the store, his wife, Robert took a liking to his wife, and Robert had a little room in a section of Greenwood called Baptist Town. It was the African American section of Greenwood, still there. And her sister, this woman's sister, also lived in Baptist Town. And so she used to tell her husband, well, you know, I'm going in to see my sister. I'm going in to see my sister. I'm going in to see my sister. And she was actually going in to spend time with Robert. And the husband found out about it. And apparently in those days, it was not uncommon to slip naphthalene, ground up mothballs. It was the active ingredients in mothballs, in somebody's drink, particularly if they were like an unruly drunk or something, and you wanted to get rid of them at your juke or your bar. Because what it would do is it would make you really ill. It would make you nauseous and vomit, and just make you feel really lousy. It wasn't enough to kill you, but it would just make you feel really, really, really bad. So that's what he wanted to do to Robert. He wanted to just like disrupt, you know, one of his performances and just like teach him a lesson. What he didn't know was that before going to Greenwood, Robert had been in Memphis, and Robert's half-sister Carrie heard him complaining about stomach pains and said, you need to go see somebody. You need to go see somebody. So he went to see a doctor, and the doctor diagnosed him as having an ulcer, probably a severe ulcer, and swollen varices in his esophagus, which often comes from years of alcoholism. And Robert was a major drinker. Everybody who knew him from the road always said Robert was drunk more often than not. He was drunk more than not. You know, when I asked Johnny, you know, did he drink? Johnny laughed and said, don't ask me did he drink, just ask me what he drank. And so when he was given this drink, it did make him violently ill. As I said, it wasn't enough to kill him, but it made him begin to vomit. It made his ulcer rupture, and the vomiting made his the varices in his esophagus rupture, which even today, you only have, if that happens, you only have something like a 50% chance of recovery, even receiving doctor's treatment. It's very serious. You know, think about it, the veins in your throat rupturing and bleeding, you know, That's really serious. And so Robert spent almost 3 days, not unlike the legend, literally crawling around, howling in pain and vomiting blood until he eventually died from bleeding to death.
And he didn't get any medical attention?
No, no.
The legend of Robert Johnson as we know it really began to grow and build around the 60s. What started that?
In the 50s, particularly the later 50s, and this is one of the things that's responsible for the folk music revival, you had a lot of, I call them the 78 geeks, But you had a lot of college age students, you know, who would.
Hey, I'm a Victrola geek. Okay. I've been playing my Victrola during this pandemic.
Me too. But it was different in that regard because these were people, largely young white guys, you know, who would go oftentimes just to Salvation Army stores or whatever, and just buy boxes and boxes of old 78s. You know, they became fixated with 78s. And, you know, a lot of it would be like garbage, you know. And every once in a while, you know, they'd get lucky and they'd come across a Charlie Patton record or a Willie Brown record or a Robert Johnson record. And then you had people like my co-author, Gail Dean Wardlow, and other people who literally used to go from door to door in the South. They'd go, you know, to black neighborhoods, and they would literally go knocking on doors from door to door. And they'd say, hi, you know, do you have any old 78s? I'll pay you 25 cents, you know, a record if you have any. And a lot of records surfaced that way. And so little by little, you know, people began to hear, again, it was a very niche audience, but these people began to hear this stuff, and it was like, wow, wait a minute, this is not like How Much Is Your Doggy in the Window? This is like some really different stuff. My God, listen to how this person is playing, listen to how they're singing, listen to what they're singing about. And so, you know, the whole folk music revival begins to explode during the late 50s. We have the first, you know, Newport Folk Festival at the end of the 1950s. And a lot of it is because this music was being rediscovered. Not just blues, but you know, the early country got the Carter family and, you know, all Riley Puckett, you know, and the Light Crust Doughboys, you know, all of the really quality, you know, folk country blues recordings were being rediscovered. And so we had a new audience for it. And then in 1961, Columbia decides to launch, you know, this new series of recordings, of reissues. And it's Hammond's idea that one of the first people he wants to reissue is Robert Johnson. And so in 1961, with the Frank Driggs producing and writing the liner notes, the album Robert Johnson, King of the Delta Blues Singers, comes out. And it's the first reissue of any blues singer on a major label. First singer, not any blues singer, any country blues singer on a major label. It's on Columbia. Think about it.
That's huge.
And so, yeah, it's enormous. And so that's the time. That's the moment when people like Eric Clapton and Keith Richards and John,
you know, Jimmy Page, everybody,
you know, myself included, you know, that's when we all heard this. And it was like, well, holy cow. You know, first of all, we had never heard anything like it because the recordings were just like so incredible. The liner notes were so romantically mystical. And then it's called King of the Delta Blues Singers. Well, Jesus, if John Hammond says this guy is the King of the Delta Blues Singers, he must be the best there ever was. So that's where it begins to really take off.
My guest today has been Dr. Bruce Conforth, co-author of Up Jump the Devil, The Real Life of Robert Johnson, along with Gail Dean Wardlow. You'll find it on Chicago Review Press. And that wraps up track 5 of Tex Prose and Rock and Roll. Here come this week's liner notes. Tex Prose and Rock and Roll was created, written, and executive produced by yours truly in association with GoTo Productions, Charlene Goto, producer. Special thanks this week to Bruce Conforth, Sam Hoffman, and the team at Chicago Review Press. Our narrator was Marcus Osborne, and our music this week comes from Will Roth Music and Delta Blues selections from the Lomax Archives at the Library of Congress. We are grateful when you subscribe, rate, and comment wherever you found this podcast. Our website is textprosrockandroll.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook to be among the first to see what's coming up on future tracks. You can also write to us there, and yes, we do take requests. For Tex Prose and Rock and Roll, I'm Chris Kosach. Rock on.